when she was journaling about all the victims. The boy who was whisked off to a foreign country, given a new life so different from hers. Or so she thought. "Lila Turlington," she says. "He's her son." "Yes. The Bannings killed his mother and her boyfriend just like they killed your mother. After their disappearance, he was taken out of the country, given a new identity." The uncle, the one who works in gas pipelines. "Exactly. Dylan was protected from things you weren't, but given my experience of him, I don't imagine it was a very pleasant upbringing." She gently slides the picture page to one side, sees what looks like the records of Dylan's military service Kayla couldn't find. References to kills and assassinations with the word "classified" stamped across the top, which seems pathetic. The word should be red, but instead it's black and white, which means these documents are photocopies made by someone who wasn't supposed to have them. Too dense to read through now. But it's something. Far more than she expected out of the guy sitting across from her. "And what's your experience of him?" she asks.
"Dylan was one of my father's last hires before he passed away. When I became CEO, Dylan came to me with video evidence of animal testing he'd done on a new drug. He'd been trying to advance anti-anxiety medications beyond what he called the realm of alcohol in a pill. He was searching for a compound that suppressed certain panic responses in the brain that can lead to paralysis and other fear responses he deemed ineffective. Given what I've just shown you, it's not a mystery where this obsession came from. I know you were very young, and I know you weren't involved in any of their murders. So, I'm not sure how much time you spent researching the details of their crimes, the statements Abigail has made in prison."
She nods weakly.
"Then you're probably aware Abigail Banning told authorities and several journalists that Lila Turlington froze up when they attacked her boyfriend. That they almost bungled it, and there was a moment when she could have got away, maybe even saved Eddie Stevens. But she was paralyzed by the shock of it all. Two perfectly nice people she thought were fellow backpackers sharing a campfire, suddenly turning on her boyfriend with a rock. She froze.
Abigail lied about a lot of things.
Even so, the story seems to have had a particular effect on the man we know as Dylan Cody, born Noah Turlington in Asheville, North Carolina."
"I knew him as Dylan Thorpe."
Indeed. It's been hard to keep track of everyone's name of late."
"I only have one, and it's Charlotte Rowe." Cole smiles nervously, nods.
"Of course."
"These animal tests? What did they show?"
"In 200 of them, Dylan matched prey and predator in a contained environment after dosing the prey subject with Zyprexin. In only 5 of them did the predator survive."
"What did you do after he showed you these tests?"
"I made arrangements to begin human testing. On willing volunteers."
"I'm going to assume this trial was off the books."
"It was."
"How did it go?"
"Not well."
"How not well? Is that explained in this file?"
"It went so badly, I shut down Project Bluebird 6 months later. Pulled all Dylan's funding and denied him access to his labs."
"Bluebird." The word lances through her. The bird in the cage, the bird waiting to be set free, the bird she almost killed as a child. Anyone who knows her story would know the symbolism, and Dylan picked it as the name for the most important work of his career.
"So, very badly. What happened to the subjects? These willing volunteers?"
"Charlie, I thought we were trusting each other," she says.
While none of the men across from her reaches for a weapon, they stiffen at her volume, this subtle reminder of what she's capable of, and how they're trapped in a confined airborne space with those skills.
"They tore themselves apart," Cole answers. "Quite literally. We called it going lichen."
He lets her absorb this. Lets it sink in. How much danger Dylan put her in by giving her the drug without her consent. The possibility of being raped by Jason Briffle was the least of it.
We conducted extensive psychological profiles on each man to determine what his fears and phobias were. We tried to avoid asking the question directly because we didn't want them to anticipate the tests that lay ahead. Once the profile was complete, we took them to a secure location and set them loose in a kind of obstacle course where they were presented with different physical variations of their greatest fears. For some, it was confined spaces. For others, it was the possibility of drowning. A snake in an unexpected place. We called it the fear matrix.
But it worked, she said. They each got triggered.
Yes. But unlike in the animal testing he'd done, they didn't direct their aggression outward. They directed their aggression at what they saw as the real source of their fear. Themselves. Their minds and the bodies those minds controlled. We did everything we could to stop them. But imagine. The strength you just showed Frederick Pemberton channeled entirely into self-destructive impulses, along with aggression toward anyone or anything who tried to block those impulses once they were triggered, and imperviousness to any drugs we could dart them with. Imagine that, and you will have some sense of the nightmare Dylan Cody unleashed in our labs.
Our labs, she thinks. A secure location. Where? An island? She doubts that's in the file, and she doubts he'd tell her the truth if she asked. You tested all these men at once? She asks.
No. The second, third, and fourth all went in believing there was something inherent in their character that would allow them to improve on the results of the man who went before. After Dylan convinced them of this, of course.
And then you shut it down.
And then Dylan came to me and told me he thought the problem was that we were only testing it on men, and that we should start testing it on women, and then I shut it down.
So he left the company?
Yes.
You didn't have him followed? She asked.
For a time. He bounced from city to city. Worked odd jobs so far beneath his pay grade I thought he might disappear forever. He was drinking heavily. It was clear there was no connection to family, no friends. His uncle passed away several years ago. There's an inheritance of some kind stashed away, but he doesn't spend it very often. If there's a lot to spend, that is.
Not a lot to a man with his own helicopter, probably, she says.
Touché.
Cole smiles, but his smiles are becoming more strained with each passing minute of this flight.
I thought his failure, what happened to those men, had broken him.
And you were wrong, she says. Cole sits forward, resting his elbows on his knees and staring directly into her eyes.
If I'd had one inkling of what he was going to do to you, Charlotte, I would have stopped him. You must know this. You must believe this.
How?
I would have had no shortage of ideas on that front. I guarantee you. I don't run a convenience store. I'm the CEO of one of the most powerful companies in the world.
There's no arguing with the icy conviction in his tone. So that's why Zypraxin works on me? She asks. Because I'm a woman?
No.
She must be visibly startled by his answer. He gives her a few seconds to recover.
Dylan says he altered the formula a bit and tested it in another woman before you. The results were apparently as catastrophic as he should have expected.
Did she?
He says she agreed to it, knowing the risks. But I no longer put much stock in anything Dylan says. Do you?
You tell me. Your history with him is longer than mine. Is he wincing or smiling or both? She can't tell. What do you want from me, Cole Graydon? Just my blood?
You're angry with me. even after all I've told you. Can you tell me why?
You allowed him to do this.
That's not true. I told you. I had no idea he was even in Arizona, much less that he'd made contact with you under false pretenses. When he came to me after the mess he made with those bikers, he was desperate. He was pretending like he'd planned it all, but it was clear he hadn't. He'd lost you, and he was on the run, and he knew that both of you would be in serious trouble if I didn't step in right away.
You put me under constant surveillance. You allowed him to watch my every move.
No, I watched your every move because you were a miracle, Charlotte, and even you knew it. Because the drug was working for the first time, and on top of that, you seemed determined to actually use it. As for your surveillance, I fed him only what I wanted him to see, which was almost nothing. I also kept law enforcement from following a trail from that biker massacre to your Uncle Marty's front door in Altamira. Right now, Dylan's holed up in a shack outside of Tucson under constant surveillance, and he'll be there for the rest of his natural life, if I so choose. Or someplace worse.
He said I had to perform. He said I had to put on a show for all of you. He said you were so rich and powerful there was no outrunning you.
He was wrong. And I'm here to tell you how.
I don't understand.
I'm here to tell you how to make us all go away, if that's what you want. If that's truly what you want, I'm here to do the thing Dylan didn't do in Arizona.
What's that?
Give you a choice.
I'm listening.
What you did tonight, it was remarkable. It required a level of bravery unlike any I've ever seen. And if you would like to keep doing it, I can make that happen. I can make it happen in a much safer and more controlled way. I can provide the support and the tools you need to remove all the kinks, shall we say, in tonight's operation, so that you can take some of the worst human monsters out of circulation for all time.
And what do you get out of it?
You would, in essence, of your own free will, become our test subject. But in that capacity, we would treat you with the utmost care and respect. Provided you follow certain guidelines.
Such as?
Extensive medical testing after each use of the drug. Allowing yourself to be monitored as well. When you're not pursuing a subject like Pemberton, your life would be your own. Altamira, Marty, Luke, the new resort that's set to open soon. I imagine there will be employment opportunities there for all three of you, if you're interested.
Because you own the place now, she thinks. And what about Dylan? Will I be working with him?
Not directly, no.
But what's the point? What will the testing be for?
The goal remains the same.
You're going to find a way to sell this drug? To make it work in everyone? That's insane.
Of course not. The goal will be a stable, restrained, marketable version of Zyprexin that will do nothing more than inhibit those elements of the panic response that are counterproductive to survival mechanisms in populations at risk of being exposed to severe violence.
He seems comforted by this string of buzzwords and marketing speak. He smiles wistfully. Like a man who's just recounted a fond memory of his hometown.
The goal will be a drug that could have saved your mother's life.
You're gonna start marketing a drug that allows women to rip men in half?
Stable. Restrained. It won't happen overnight. It'll be years before we get there. But with you, we're closer than we've ever been. And I imagine the breakthroughs along the way will be considerable. To say nothing of the women whose lives will be saved by your work before then. How many more masks do you think Pemberton would have made if you hadn't stopped him tonight?
I don't actually know what you've done with him, so he could still end up making more.
One thing at a time, Charlie.
Okay. And the other choice? She asks.
Walk away, and we all pretend the last week or so never happened. I might keep some tabs on you, but only to make sure you aren't sharing too extensively about our time together. But your life will be your own, albeit a little less exciting than if you had chosen to work with us.
You'd let me just walk away after everything you told me.
After everything you've done? For sure, Charlie.
She can't tell if he's referring to her so-called bravery or the multiple hacks Bailey's committed on her behalf.
Okay.
And Dylan?
He would have to die.
At first, she thinks his gentle, conciliatory smile is a sign he's kidding. But as it fades and his eye contact doesn't waver, she realizes he's absolutely serious. For the next few seconds, there's only the muffled chop of the rotary blades overhead as the helicopter swings back to the west.
You're serious? She asks.
Yes.
So if I refuse to work with you, you'll let me go back to my life, but you're gonna... what, hunt Dylan down and shoot him?
It'll be more elegant than that, but that's the basic idea, yes.
Everything else the man has said to her tonight has felt clinical, rehearsed down to the last word, but there's something in his expression now that seems raw and electric. She wonders if she had a similar look in her eyes when she snapped Pemberton's wrist. He's out for some kind of revenge, and he's using her to do it.
Why?
She asks.
Why? He gave you a drug without your knowledge that might have caused you to tear yourself apart.
You don't care about me. You don't even know me.
For 2 years he developed that drug with my complete support. That makes me responsible for you.
Right, but if you were so outraged by what he'd done, why not kill him the minute he told you?
I wanted to see if he was telling the truth.
You didn't need him alive to see that. You could have just followed me like you did.
He nods. He's surveying her.
Maybe if she wasn't capable of bashing his head in, he'd have killed her for speaking this kind of truth to him.
Maybe he's just that kind of guy.
Maybe that's how he got his own helicopter.
Forgive me, Charlie, for the speech I'm about to make. And let me qualify it by saying I really do believe that all people are created equal, even if a fair amount of them go to shit not long after they're created. But you need to know this. I'm not like you. I'm not like anyone you know, and I'm not like anyone you will ever meet. I sit at the head of a company that will make more money in the next 5 minutes than most people would be able to earn in 10 lifetimes. The products that I deliver to the world save thousands of lives every minute all over the planet. And the development and manufacture of those products that people now demand at the drop of a hat for almost nothing, comes at a cost those same people cannot bring themselves to examine. It's my job to deliver those products while concealing that cost at all times. That's my duty. That's what I go to bed with every night. Now, I realize we live in the age of the social justice warrior who thinks he can ferret out all the corruption in the world just by doing some Google searches, but the fact of the matter is this. While everyone points the finger at Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and the like, it's companies like mine that actually shape the world, and we have this responsibility because people gave it to us. Because they expect to be relieved of every ache and pain and bad mood, as if being alive itself is a pathological condition, and someone somewhere is responsible for fixing it. And we meet that need. We meet that need in the hopes that we can someday wrest enough financial gain from this neurotic hunger that we end up developing a cure for cancer, or a drug that stops strokes once and for all, or a drug that allows people at a risk of violence or abuse to defend themselves in a competent, focused, and effective manner. Something that's truly important, not just easily marketable. That's my job, in a nutshell. That's my responsibility, and it was my father's before he left it to me. And if you decide to wash your hands of all this, then Project Bluebird is dead forever. I've got no more to give to it. And that's fine. But that also means Dylan Cody, or Dylan Thorpe, or Noah Turlington, or whatever he chooses to call himself tomorrow, has no more to give me or my company except dangerous and unacceptable risks, and I can't have that. I can't have that at all.
The pictures still stare up at her from the spread of pages on her lap. The boy with the murdered mother, and the mad scientist he became. Why tell me? She asks. Why make me responsible for his life? Why not just deal with Dylan the way you want to?
If you do decide to work with us, I don't want to jeopardize our new relationship. For all I know, you might have developed a real attachment to him.
You certainly seem to have one.
I'll show you some footage of what happened to the test subjects in our labs. That way you'll appreciate the magnitude of the danger he placed you in.
Or you could admit that you just want him dead, but you can't bring yourself to do it unless you use me as an excuse.
I'd dismiss that as glib if you didn't speak from experience. After all, you're the one who used me and my surveillance and Zypraxin as an excuse to hunt down a serial killer who reminded you of the people who killed your mother.
I didn't do it for revenge.
You could have fooled me, Burning Girl.
I'm not interested in being part of your revenge, either.
That's not what this is. But I can certainly understand why you'd see it that way.
What is it, then?
Management.
He sucks in a deep breath.
That said, this isn't a decision you need to make tonight, or the next night, or the night after that. Take your time. You've been through a great deal these past few days. Charlotte, right now I need your blood.
Maybe this was his strategy, to sideline her so she'd offer up her arm without a struggle, even though she's currently capable of snapping his neck with one hand. It works. She gives them her left arm. The wounds from where she tore out Pemberton's IVs are still fading on her right.
Mark, the spectacled former nurse, springs into action. Opening the briefcase, revealing the vials in their foam slots.
Only when he brings the syringe close to her flesh does she notice that his hands shake slightly and his nostrils flare with each breath, as if he were preparing to inject a growling tiger. Once her blood starts to fill the vial, Cole knocks on the partition behind his head. The chopper banks again, and they start flying back toward the rivers and lakes of twinkling lights beyond the dark mountains. By the time they start to descend, Mark Hetherington has filled 5 vials. When he removes the last one, she glances out the window. They're close to the Pala Casino Resort. It rises like a gatehouse to the network of mountain valleys they just took off from. Their landing spot is the empty parking lot of an unfinished shopping mall. Approaching on the nearest service road now are 2 large black SUVs she recognizes from outside the vineyard's gate, and Luke's Jeep in between them. As the 3 cars pull into the lot, she's surprised to see Luke and Marty emerge from the backseat of the first SUV, and not the Jeep. Apparently Luke's vehicle has been commandeered by more of Cole's windbreaker-clad Glock aficionados, like the guys now fanning out across the perimeter of their impromptu helipad. The man driving Luke's Jeep hops out, then disappears into the back seat of the SUV in front. Whatever's about to happen, it's going to be a quick transfer, and as the chopper's runners come to rest on the asphalt, she realizes most of the men and the firepower are still up at Pemberton's place. But her people are all here. Luke, Marty, Brasher, Rucker, and the 3 guys who were supposed to be at the surveillance post. They don't look traumatized, just shaken and confused, like students evacuated from a school after a phony bomb threat. The windbreakers, as she now thinks of them, are falling back and piling into the SUVs. Ed Baker slides open the door to the passenger compartment, allowing in a blast of air as the blades roar by overhead. This time, she realizes,
The helicopter won't be shutting down.
I'll be in touch, Charlotte,
Cole says.
Not with quite this much fanfare, of course, but soon. I would offer you my hand, but...
She reaches out and grips the edge of the door, careful not to bend the metal. In her other hand, she holds the file.
Oh, and Charlie?
She looks at him.
In another few hours, Frederick Pemberton is going to tell a very strange story to the authorities. We'll do everything we can to make sure they don't believe it. But I wouldn't stick around, if I were you.
She wants to ask him more questions, but she doubts he'll give her the whole truth. You and Dylan make a great couple, she says. It's a shame you want him dead.
No sooner has she stepped from the helicopter than Baker slides the door shut behind her, and suddenly it's lifting into the air over her head, the downdraft plastering her hair to one side of her face. But of course, her grip, magnified by Zyprexin, is more than enough to keep the contents of the file from blowing out of her hand. In time with the helicopter's departure, the two SUVs speed back onto the service road, leaving Luke's Jeep all by itself, several yards away, its doors standing open.
Luke is walking toward her, too fast.
Wait, she says.
No, he says.
Suddenly his arms are around her.
If you can't hug me without crushing my spine, then just don't hug back, he whispers.
She leaves her arms at her sides. She leans into him. She can do that, right? Just a little lean? A little movement that allows her to shift some of the weight off her heels and onto the balls of her feet. To breathe deeply for the first time in hours. For the first time in days. For the first time in weeks. She blinks against his chest, sees the rest of the group headed toward her.
I'm gonna wait, if that's all right, darling, Marty says. Maybe another hour and a half or so. I'm not quite as brave as him.
She smiles, nods against Luke's chest. She's allowed her eyes to drift shut again when she hears one of the other guys say,
We need to get her some new jeans.
Part 4. It's been 2 weeks, and this is what the world thinks happened that night. They think the mask maker, a.k.a. Frederick Pemberton, was rearranging equipment in his surgical lab of horrors when he accidentally pushed one of the operating tables into the vacuum pump chamber he used to create his masks, knocking the giant chamber onto its side. They think he almost pinned himself underneath it, breaking several bones in the process. They think he was so afraid a trip to the hospital would expose the source of his injuries, he chose instead to inject himself with a powerful pain medication until he could figure out what to do. And because he was in so much pain, he made the mistake of dosing himself with one of the tranquilizers he used to subdue his victims, knocking himself unconscious in the process. After he passed out, his dogs escaped through a driveway gate he'd failed to close all the way behind himself earlier that evening. Given their reputation as fearsome beasts, it took only one or two sightings of the dogs running along Pala Temecula Road before neighbors placed concerned calls to local law enforcement. A little while later, a routine door knock ended up unmasking one of the most sadistic serial killers in American history. Since then, cable news has been filled with criminal justice and forensics experts who can't get enough of this story. Of its crazy irony, a killer being brought down by the implements of his crimes. None of them have paused to wonder if it's all too neat, if perhaps the whole thing was staged. Maybe they do, just during the commercial breaks. If Cole Graydon's men left behind any evidence that a combat-ready team of soldiers had practically blown the place apart in the minutes before I was triggered, local law enforcement hasn't found any of it. As for Pemberton, the contents of his confession have not yet been made public, aside from the fact that it's most definitely a confession, What other choice did he have? The experts ask. Was he really going to insist that the entire contents of his lab, right down to the three faceless corpses in his refrigerator, were somehow carted in and staged there while he slept on the floor? How would he explain the fact that all of it was slathered with his fingerprints? Maybe he's told them some crazy story about one of his victims overpowering him, but if he has, the police sure aren't acting on it. I'm sure I have Cole Graydon and his men to thank for that. Defeat. That's how, in the eyes of the world, the story of the Mask Maker has ended. Total, pathetic defeat. And I'm not gonna lie, this satisfies me. It does more than that, to be honest. It makes me very happy. So happy that I'm not afraid to admit to myself, and to Luke, and to Marty, that my memory of the fear in his eyes, the pain in his expression as I snapped his wrist, does not fill me with guilt. Every now and then I feel like it might. But then I close my eyes and try to imagine the faces of the women whose lives I probably saved, going about their daily business, laughing, loving, crying over silly movies. Future victims of the Mask Maker who might have looked away too quickly from Frederick Pemberton's unusual features. I removed from the world the hours of agony and torment and terror Pemberton's next victims would have suffered at his hands. Save the world? Maybe not. Make it a better place? I think so. It took me about 3 days to realize this. You could say I was in shock, but it wasn't the kind of shock I've heard described by car accident victims. I wasn't speechless or paralyzed. It was like I was skating across the surface of what had happened. Like if I just didn't talk about everything I'd done, it would eventually seem perfectly normal. So I went about my days at Marty's house, then at Luke's, because his place was bigger, showering, eating, and watching cable news coverage of Pemberton's arrest. It was strange logging into my email, but it didn't bring me back to reality the way I expected. The messages waiting there just seemed like terse dispatches from a life that wasn't mine anymore. Most of them inquiries from the travel agency I worked for. The first message was politely curious. The second, concerned. The third, arriving after I'd missed my second shift in a row, was all disciplinary talk of probation. In the fourth, I was fired. And then there were the voicemails on my cell phone. Several from the Scarlet Police Department. From one of the cops I'd met when I went to register my alarm. Poor guy. He'd sounded so halting and nervous. Probably overwhelmed by federal agents. I thought I could hear some of them talking in the background. He just wanted to know if I was out there, is all. They'd tried knocking, ringing my buzzer. There'd been a big mess out in the desert nearby, if I hadn't heard. Could I get back to them as soon as I could? 5 calls over the course of 2 days. Then they'd stopped altogether as the attention of the federal agencies involved was directed to other sources by an invisible, powerful hand. Thanks, Cole. Did he call politician friends and get them to look away? Did he blackmail federal agents into extending their investigation south toward Scarlet and not north toward my house? I'm in no mood to ask the guy. If I ask him anything, I'll be required to answer his questions first, and I'm not ready for that. Not yet. Around sunset one night, Luke drove me out to the beach and Bayard Rock. He told me it was where he used to bring Bailey when their mom was sick. Bailey's got no interest in coming home, apparently. This has hurt Luke's feelings all over again. Apparently, the fact that we've made powerful new friends who could probably get Bailey back in the country, maybe even keep the FBI off his back, means nothing to him. Wherever he is, whoever he's working with, he's happy there. And it's hard for Luke to argue with him. because wherever Bailey is, whoever he's working with, allowed us to take a vicious monster out of circulation. So, can we really complain? There are already construction vehicles out at the old resort, clearing out debris, getting ready to pick up where they left off. There are advertisements for job fairs in town. Mostly construction stuff, but they're also interviewing for positions at the hotel once it opens. Kitchen staff, housekeeping, stuff like that. It makes me dizzy to think all that might go away if I turn down Cole's offer. For a while, Luke and I sat, watching the sunset. I've taken his physical affection for granted these past few days. At first, it just seemed like a natural outgrowth of what we'd been through. Now it's constant and welcome. And so, when I rested my head against his shoulder as we sat together on the sand, it didn't seem like a big deal. And when he took my hand in his and held it against his chest, it didn't seem like a big deal either. When our lips finally met, it felt necessary, essential. Not the forceful, desperate thing I'd seen in movies, and nothing like the hesitant, exploratory hour I'd spent with that guy I met on my road trip. It felt like an extension of what we'd been through. To kiss him. To get as close to his woodsy smell as I possibly could. To learn that his lower lip is sensitive, and if I lift my hands to the sides of his neck and just graze my fingers gently across the muscle there, he gets shivers all over his body. He doesn't just laugh. He giggles. And then he gets embarrassed that he's giggling, tries to turn it into a manly laugh, and ends up coughing. Which I really like. A lot. I never anticipated that just kissing someone could be an event. With different stages and acts. The slow approach, the commitment, the taste, the smell, the withdrawal, and then going back in for a second taste, a deeper one. It's happened 3 times, and we haven't had some big talk about it. We haven't named it. And we haven't tried to get each other's clothes off. For now, it's just something we need, even though it's brief, even though it's nameless. For now. We're together right now, as I write this, on a plane headed for Atlanta. The emails from Cole have been pretty steady the past 2 weeks. They all say the same thing. Ready to hear your decision when you've made it. See. But there's only been one email from Dylan, and it arrived yesterday. Let's meet. So much to discuss, it seems. D. Followed by a screen cap of a Google map of an area I knew all too well. Marty offered to go with me, but I could tell he was at risk of losing several jobs, given how much time he'd spent away. Luke had put in regular shifts ever since we got back, and he'd told Mona a good enough cover story to explain his absence. 24 hours. That's how long we've scheduled this trip for. 24 hours that could decide my fate. And Dylan's. It seems insane to be writing in this notebook again. What if I dropped it or lost it? Whoever picked it up would probably think it was someone's idea of a novel, that's what. Maybe it's as simple as I can't really think of anything else to do with my hands right now. It's a long flight, SFO to Atlanta. About 4 hours. And Luke's only pretending to watch the movie on his phone. I can tell. Still, it's comforting to have him next to me. It's comforting to know he watched me do what I did in Pemberton's basement, and he doesn't recoil from me. He isn't afraid of me. He doesn't believe some incurable darkness has been unleashed in me. He looks at me with a protectiveness and steadiness I've never seen in the eyes of another man. It's not like the way Marty looks at me, with a lot of smiles and winks to hide how worried he is. Luke is there. Present. Constant.
Ready. Which is good, because I need him. I need this journal, too. I need these words. They're mine. They exist between all the other versions of my life that have been forced on me over the years. They exist outside the terrible choice Cole Graydon has given me. Maybe this really will be the last chapter of the story that began with my mother's murder. Maybe I really will walk away, no matter what that entails. If I do, does that mean I should keep this book or burn it? Cole sent me another email this morning. I got it as we were boarding. Hope you have a productive meeting. I look forward to seeing your decision. See. I showed it to Luke. Seeing, he said back to me. So I wasn't the only one who noticed the unusual wording. So they're going to be watching us, he said. I nodded. Watching us today? And maybe always. If that's the price of being able to bring Pemberton's madness to an end, of saving the lives of his future victims, is it worth it? If I had an answer, I wouldn't be asking you, Journal. 41. Her arrival at the farm is relatively painless at first, because she doesn't recognize anything. It's all so overgrown. On the drive in from Atlanta, the seas of rolling green mountains reminded her more of the gravesite tour she took right before she moved to Arizona than it did her fragmented recollections of early childhood. By the time she and Luke reach the old chain where the entrance to the access road used to be, they've been trespassing for about 20 minutes. But she figures, if the owners of the farm that bought up all the Bannings' property years ago come bursting out of the trees with shotguns raised, Cole will somehow intervene. What tipped him off, she wonders? Was it that they booked their airline tickets in their own names? Or has he been tracking Dylan's emails? She figures it's the latter. It's cold at this altitude. Colder than it was in Atlanta. Their breath fogs the air. Luke pushes brush back with gloved hands. Someone, probably morbid hikers, and if the rumors are true, the owners of the property who led them on guided hikes here, have beaten a trail through the brush to the front steps, where she used to sit with Abigail and watch for birds. She and Luke follow it now. They're several yards from the house when someone steps out onto the porch. Dylan's dressed like a preppy backpacker, a new-looking waffle-print coat, lightly scuffed jeans, and shiny black boots. This is how Dylan Thorpe, the privileged but kind-hearted therapist she knew in Arizona, would dress if he took off on a hike in a colder climate. She reminds herself not to be fooled by the outfit. By the look. He's not Dylan Thorpe, she thinks as they stare at each other. He's not even Dylan Cody. He's Noah Turlington. Think of him that way and it will be easier not to hate him. Or, at the least, your hatred won't show. He gestures for them to follow him inside. When she first spotted the remains of the farmhouse, she assumed it had been through several fires. Now that she's inside, she can see its time and weather that had eaten away at its roof and walls, leaving holes so large they look like evidence of cannon blasts. The fireplace has been conquered by a blend of vines and weeds, watered, it looks like, by a steady diet of rain. The center of the brick mantle gave way a long time ago. Below, the bricks sit where they landed, black as coal where they aren't covered by leaves. One entire corner of the house, including the large window from which she used to watch snow fall and birds congregate at the feeder outside, has collapsed, flooding the interior with sunlight that exposes the morbid graffiti along the walls. It's the same bargain basement posier Satanist crap she's seen in pictures of the place online. Skulls, upside-down stars, crude outlines of heads she only realizes are supposed to be the devil when she finally sees the crooked horns on top.
At floor level, tiny altars left by the visitors line the walls. Defaced stuffed animals, some of them tied to black pillar candles. Like so many of the tributes to the Bannings that persist on the internet, the offerings here are a crazy mishmash of grief for the victims and a perverse celebration of their killers. As if her and Noah's mother weren't claimed by maniacs, but by a dark god who demands constant reverence. She can imagine Jason Briffle crouching down in these shadows, maybe with some of his letters from Abigail tucked in his pocket, lighting one of the intact candles. This would be his church. For her, this house, the fields outside, the entire property, is a gory delivery room where her true self was yanked from the womb by a well-armed SWAT team acting as OBGYNs. But what is it for Dylan? For Noah, she corrects herself. There are maps online that claim to show the locations where each body was buried before her rescue. So maybe he spent some time standing over his mother's first, forced grave. If the victims were taken from an isolated location like her mother, their car was buried here too. Even today, the most popular crime scene photos are aerial shots of the so-called automobile graveyard, where the rusted skeletons of the freshly unearthed cars looked like fossils emerging from the sands of history. Has he never been here before? Was he saving it for their reunion? As they stand together, inside this crumbling ruin, she feels exactly the type of kinship with him she had hoped to avoid. It's the expression on his face as he studies these walls, she thinks. Unguarded, wide-eyed, free of anything that looks like calculation. Behind her, Luke stands just inside the front door, watching Dylan's every move. I have something for you, Dylan finally says. When he extends one hand toward her, Luke takes a step, boards creaking underfoot. A link of shiny gold dangles from Dylan's outstretched fist. She recognizes it instantly, extends her hand, gesturing with the other for Luke to stay back. Jason Briffle's necklace, the one he wore to her house, drops into her palm. Most of it is blackened from intense fire, the ends melted from the heat. The sight of the tiny medallion of flames, now soot-covered, makes Jason's break-in seem like minutes and not weeks ago. I would never have let him hurt you. She looks at him in disbelief. Not because she thinks he's lying, because she didn't expect his candor. So you were outside the whole time? She asks. You followed me home. He nods. Without thinking, she tosses the necklace toward the nearest grim altar. When his gift lands atop a rotting pile of burned offerings, Dylan flinches. You have every right to be angry with me. But he doesn't sound like he believes it, only that he thinks he should. How much did Cole tell you about me? That your life hangs in my hands, she thinks. That if I refuse to keep being a guinea pig, he'll probably shoot you dead. Right here, for all I know. Did he tell you that when I came to him with the first animal tests of Zypraxin, he'd squandered millions of research dollars hunting for common links between orphan diseases? That he was losing the confidence of his board and he'd only been CEO for a year? Do you know what that phrase means, orphan disease? She shakes her head. It's a disease so rare there's no real financial incentive for a company like Graydon to find a cure for it, or even a treatment. But Cole, for some crazy reason, got it in his head that with the right amount of money and determination, and as it turned out, ignorance, he'd find some commonality between random, isolated, rare diseases and somehow develop treatments for them. His umbrella theory. That's what he called it. It was complete nonsense, and he almost ruined his father's company over it. And then you came to him with a cure for something else, she says.
A cure,
he says.
Maybe. More like a weapon.
A weapon that could have saved your mother.
And yours.
And you killed 4 men to make it work.
4 willing volunteers gave their lives so we could try to make it work. We weren't out to create a Superman pill. We wanted to formulate something that could seize on the biochemical process of panic itself and transform it into efficiency, competency, responsiveness.
Survival, she whispers before she can stop herself. He looks into her eyes, smiles slightly. Pleased, no doubt, that she's just parroted the word he used to justify his actions the night Jason almost raped her.
Exactly, he says. The strength was an unexpected byproduct, and one with undeniable defense industry implications that, I will admit, I did use to secure funding for our further development.
But it didn't work. So you decided to put my life at risk.
I knew it would work in you. I had a theory. I was right.
What was your theory?
Our tests used combat veterans. People who'd been through extreme physical trauma. Trauma so severe it had reshaped their neural pathways. With you, that wasn't a concern.
You're saying my life's been free of trauma?
Your life is full of grief, betrayal, and loss. But the only time you were ever held down against your will was when the SWAT team saved you from this place. You've never been shot, or even shot at, much less beaten, violated. The threat of those things has been ever-present in your life, as it is in so many lives, but it never manifested.
Until you sent Jason to my house.
Yes. And we all saw how that went.
I don't believe you, Noah. He closes his eyes at the use of his old name. What's he trying to summon? Patience or violence?
Which part?
He finally asks quietly. I don't believe you were so confident your pill wouldn't kill me. I think you thought I was expendable.
How, Charlotte?
They're thoughts that have only come to her in the past few days, so she's afraid she might have trouble articulating them now. But when she starts to speak, the words come easily. Is she saddened or relieved to be saying these things? I think you tracked me down because you knew who I was and you hated me. You thought I'd made money off the Bannings, off your mother's murder. You'd already lost a female subject. Maybe it was someone you cared about. Now you needed one you wouldn't care about at all.
Interesting,
he says.
So naturally, I spent 3 months getting to know you so that I wouldn't be attached when you went lichen on me and I had to destroy you.
Those 3 months gave you everything you needed to set up your test.
2 weeks gave me everything I needed to set up my test. You were desperate for someone to talk to, and after our first session, you rarely held back.
Better for you, then.
But that's not why I was there. Not in the beginning.
She's startled by his conviction, but he doesn't rush to say more. Why were you there? She asks.
I wanted to know who you really were. You're right. I hated you. Ever since I found out who my mother really was, what had happened to her, I hated you. I'd read your father's crass, manipulative, disingenuous book. I'd watched every single one of those disgusting films, knowing you got a share of the profits. And I'd never believed a word you'd said in front of a camera. I thought it was all for show, all for money. Even storming off stage on your father like that, just a teenager getting bored with her old act. And I thought, deep down,
You probably hated your father because you loved them more. Abigail and Daniel, your real parents? In short, I believed everything about you you didn't want the world to believe. She's never seen him this angry. It takes a form as penetrating and focused as every other intense swell of emotion he's displayed. And then? She asks. And then, one day, I saw you standing over my mother's grave. For a second, she's got no idea what he's talking about. Then she remembers. The road trip. The road trip she wrote about in her journal only days before. After Cole shut down the project, it was like my one connection to my mother died. I wandered around for a bit, but I ended up in Asheville where she lived. I was trying to put together pieces of her life, and then one day I walked out to her grave and there you were. Burning girl. And you were crying. I'd seen the news, I'd read about the lawsuit. I knew you'd won. But you weren't off vacationing on some island. Instead, you'd traveled across the country to bring my mother her favorite flower. And that's when I realized. We don't get to pick the other survivors of the shipwreck. And on our darkest days, they're all we have. So I decided to find out who you really were. You followed me all the way to Arizona. I followed you back to Asheville. Heard you use your new name. I used that to do the rest. The rest. Pretending to be a therapist. Lying to me. It was not my best plan. In the beginning, it wasn't really a plan at all. It was... What? She asks. What was it? Hope. For what, Noah? He whirls, a visible pulse in one corner of his jaw. I call you by the name you've chosen. Can you do me the same favor? You didn't do me any favors, Dylan. His shame, if that's truly what it is, shows itself in the quick breath he sucks in through his nostrils, the speed with which he looks out into the woods beyond. Should she tell him they're being watched? Shouldn't he already know? After all, he's worked with Cole Graydon far longer than she has. So who was I? She asks. When you finally got to know the real me, who did I turn out to be? You were everything I said you were during our sessions. Brave, but deluded. Convinced you were weak simply because you were grief-stricken and exhausted. But on a fundamental level, what you'd been through had turned you into something I'd never anticipated. Someone resourceful, determined, honest, but in need of a push. A push? Do you regret it, Charlie? Not our sessions, not what I had to do with Jason. The mask maker, do you regret it? Do you regret bringing him down? Is that what you expected me to do? Never in a million years, he says, with a warm, contented smile. And maybe you didn't get to know the real me after all. Maybe, he whispers. His smile fading, but his stare growing more intense, as if he's convinced he might learn more about her in this single moment than he did during those 3 months. You said in the beginning, I was hope? Not for your drug, but for something else. What, Dylan, hope for what? He's studying the view beyond the collapsed walls now. He's searching the woods, she's sure of it. Searching for the glint of sunlight off binoculars or a rifle scope. But he doesn't seem frightened. Dylan? I thought you might have seen her. When they brought her here. Your mother? She asks. He nods. I didn't, she whispers. I never saw any of them. I'm sorry. I would tell you the truth if I had.
I know, he whispers back. I know.